This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled Catch Me If You Can, a story of alien abductions and culprit plunder. Well, it is say culprit. Culprit plunder.
It does say culprit.
It is culprit plunder.
In the story.
Excellent. Well, it's scripted and written by our author who writes under the pen name of Thought Continuum. And I'm not sure, should I address you as Thought or Continuum or just, hey, you?
Hey. Hey, you, Kathleen Thought.
All right, Kathleen.
All of the above.
Fabulous. You're joining me from Utah in the United States. This is, at first glance, a fictional work, but you tell me that this is actually based on a factual occurrence. Tell me the inspiration behind the book, Catch Me If You Can.
The inspiration behind it, the first book, Catch Me If You Can, is a prelude to a myth that I am working on. And the inspiration for the myth came to me when there was a school bombing in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And I was watching that, and they were interviewing a woman there who had lost her children. You could hear the wailing and the sirens in the street. And she looked directly at the camera and said, where are all the women? How could you let this happen?
Hmm.
She didn't say, where are the politicians? Where are the soldiers? Where are the police? She said, where are the women? How could you let this happen? And I think I knew then that I would write a myth, that I would write a myth, that I would take this strange story of mine and find the innovation to turn it into some kind of a solution. The first book I never actually planned on writing. As I was into the myth, it occurred to me that if people didn't know who Aesop was, which is one of the extraterrestrials, then the myth wouldn't make sense. So I backed it up and wrote this book as a prequel.
This, you say, was an actual occurrence that you had interaction with alien abduction?
Yes.
And you use the word culprit plunder.
Yes.
Instead of corporate. Corporate was what comes to my mind when I'm saying culprit. Share the background of that particular line.
I show up as the culprit in this story. A culprit is somebody whose life is based on the law of distraction. You've heard a lot about the law of attraction.
Yes.
Over the last decade.
Yes.
As a culprit, my life is based on the law of distraction.
I must be one of those. I have a lot of those in my life, distractions.
So at the end of the story, it kind of turns itself around on its head, where I became aware of a lot of things while I was in that situation that I am using to my advantage to write the myth. So the culprit plunder belongs to me.
Share with my listeners a little more of the experience of abduction, because that is a fascinating topic.
Okay. In the beginning of the book, I talk a little bit about the Matrix. We've all heard about the Matrix.
Yes.
That surrounds the planet. And I got a glimpse of this Matrix. It was like a lexicon of light. It was a contextual field that surrounded the planet. And then more than that, there was a conceptual field that surrounded this contextual field that kind of held the contextual field into place, that holds our cultural stories into place. And I start the book there because the two extraterrestrial life forms that I met are connected. One of them was connected to the contextual field, and the other one was connected to the conceptual field. So the first, it was the old common story you hear, our car stopped working, the freeway lights were off. Of course, this was 1976, so
okay,
this was 76. Brand new. I don't even think the Betty and Barney Hill story was out then.
Mm-hmm.
So the first ones that I met, I call them the Weavers. They could probably call themselves something else entirely, but that's what I call them. Nowadays, I would probably call them the coders. The way that people can code computers, they code this contextual field. And then I was abducted from those beings by a separate, different, completely different extraterrestrial that I call Aesop. And Aesop calls himself Aesop too. and he's connected to the conceptual field. So I start the story out talking about those two things and then move into the abduction story.
Your textual content is a little bit different than most books that are in the marketplace as well. Where did that idea come from? And share for my listeners what you would call that style.
It's actually, for me, it's a song. I can hear it in syllables, like beats. It's also, I owned a bookstore for many, many years. I just love books. I love language. And it's actually an E.E. Cummings style. There's no capital letters. There's no contractions that show up in the story. The editors call it a free-form prose.
I was going to say that. Yes. Or actually poetry,
it's like
perhaps.
A 200-page poem. Wow. But don't let that pretty language fool you. It's very gritty. It's very honest, very raw. It's been called disturbing. It's native, creative, skillful. It kind of goes along that whole array.
Of the total content of your book, 196 pages, which of those, now that you brought it up, is the most disturbing or the most exciting event that you have shared?
Actually, it's written in three parts, and I think there's disturbing things in every single part. And the disturbing, disturbing stuff is probably this little God chip I have on my shoulder that shows up in the book. I think that's what most people are referring to.
Is there also some fun and game? Not fun and games. That would not be the right descriptive. Are there some enjoyable passages that will be entertaining?
From what I've heard, it's a laugh out loud. I don't skip over anything. There's murder, suicide, sex, drugs, aliens, the whole gamut. Girls got to sell a book.
You just had to get it all out, didn't you? tell us how long did it take to complete this telling of your story?
The book Catch Me If You Can took me about a year to write. The myth I've been working on for about 10 years. Myth is already done too. It's called Land of Myth and Not.
And would you describe it as also a memoir?
No.
No, it's fictional?
It's a myth. I don't know if myth is fictional.
Well, it's
a myth can only arise from the present moment. So they'll have trouble sticking that one in a category.
Wow. Well, it could also be like water evaporating from the ground. That also can be referred to as a myth. Or is that missed? Anyway, how would you take a couple of paragraphs and introduce this to someone and get them curious and interested in getting a copy of Catch Me If You Can?
It's really an interesting book because it's different than anything else that's out on the market right now. Most of the books are talking about the gray aliens, and that seems to be really kind of a pop culture thing right now. So the Weavers, it's my understanding that they originate from the Big Dipper, from somewhere out in the Big Dipper, and they kind of hold they kind of hold our dreams and our cultural stories in place for us. They're like guardians, or there are as essential to my well-being as food or water would be. So they're kind of like guardians.
And are they a tangible being? You actually have a touch and feel and all
that?
Yes,
very tangible. They have bodies. They were hard to look at. They showed up as kind of those old 3D pictures that just look like random geometries and colors. And if you soften your gaze, the picture will pop out at you. When I was looking at them, whatever part of them I would look at would pop out. So if I was looking at their face would pop out, their body would disappear. If I looked at their arm, their ears would disappear. I could only see them in bits and pieces, and they had like these cloaks on that almost seemed like a camouflage kind of thing. It melted into the background. It was the same color as the background. People have asked me if they were benevolent. And I think that benevolent is probably not a word that I would use. I would think I would use the word thorough. So if I had somebody that was the guardian of the dream, I think I would rather have them be thorough than benevolent. I like people to get their jobs done, do them well.
Right.
The second extraterrestrial, Aesop, he showed up and kind of snatched me away from this interview, this telepathic interview that was going on with the first set. And Aesop is made completely out of light. He's connected to the conceptual field. So he had no skin, no bones, he was just made completely out of light. He showed up as almost like an upside down treble clef, and the top of it was his head, and you can almost see the arms and legs coming out of there. And he was a little bit like origami, except instead of folding paper, he could actually fold his light into different shape sizes.
Is this a contemporary event, or did this happen back in the 70s?
This happened back in 1976, so 4 years ago.
So you're writing about an event that happened in the past.
Yes.
You had mentioned, and I dare to bring this up, okay. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Was any of that involved in this experience?
Murder, suicide.
any of that involved in this experience?
The murder suicide, the actual event started out when we'd gone to see the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Did you see that show?
Yes, I have seen it.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. I was 18 years old. It was very, very disturbing for me. And when we left the show, I just wanted off the planet. I was 18. That's that age where conformity starts to become an issue for you.
Right.
And I kind of just backstepped as far away off this planet as I could get. And I don't know if it was an out-of-body experience or what it was, but I could see the world from like way out in outer space, and that's when I saw the contextual field and the conceptual field. And I brought that up because I don't think the abduction was random. I think that when I stepped back and got that perspective of the world, that I probably stepped over some kind of tripwire and triggered all the other events that occurred that night.
It made an impression on you for sure, or you wouldn't be able to recount it in its detail today. What are my readers going to take away from reading your book?
Oh boy, that conceptual field belongs to us. They're simply the guardians of it, and that we can weave that any way we choose, that this is a consensus reality. And that we have a choice.
This must have been a challenge to go back in your memory bank and bring this forward.
It really was.
Was it? How did you get through that?
I was under the impression that you don't really, well, at least personally, I didn't really forget the event. I think what these extraterrestrials do is they use like mnemonic devices and they just file things wrong. So these extraterrestrials, the weavers, they had very long necks. And so I might have looked at that and thought, oh, giraffe, okay. So they take that event and they file it in my brain under giraffe, okay. Huh. So if somebody asked me if I've ever seen a UFO or extraterrestrial, I would check my UFO extraterrestrial file and there wouldn't be anything there. I would never think of checking under giraffe. So it's my belief that they use these mnemonic devices to file things wrong inside our heads. And so finding those files was a little bit of a challenge, but they're there.
This is an interesting book, a different book than most of you in my listening audience will find. It's titled Catch Me If You Can, A Story of Alien Abduction and Culprit Plunder, scripted by pen name Thought Continuum. Thank you for joining me today, Thought, or shall I call you Kathleen? Thank you for joining me. Where do we get copies of your book?
Oh, one more thing I want to mention about the pen name, Thought Continuum.
Yes, please do.
Aesop, the second extraterrestrial that I met, he actually called me by that name. He didn't call me by Kathleen. He called me Thought Continuum. And it's just such a fun name. It's just kind of stuck with me. I own a bookstore. I've had it on pens, tote bags, hats, cups. It's really been a lot of fun. The book is available Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, all fine book retailers.
Fantastic. And do you have a website under development?
It's www.thoughtcontinuum.net.
That should be easy to remember.
All you have to do is learn how to spell it.
No, I think we can do that. It's a thought. A THOUGHT. Continuum is CONTINUUM. Double ums. Thank you for joining me today, Kathleen.
You are very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Okay.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Six of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indie Book Publishing Line. I'm Clint Yates today, courtesy of Balboa Press. And on the line today is Joseph Sconce. He is the author of the book, The Travelers, The Wonders of Journeying in the Afterlife. And Joseph joins us now on the Indie Book Publishing and Balboa Press line. Hello, Joseph. Thanks for being with us today.
Hello. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. How's it going for you today?
Oh, fine.
Good. Good. Well, we've got your book, The Travelers. Certainly, this is probably different than a lot of people. This is, I don't want to call it obscure, and I don't want to call it not mainstream, but the ideas that you have in The Traveler are really different than what you may find in mainstream literature.
Yes, it is, because it's a book that deals in detail with how the afterlife really is, according to the belief system given to God to Swedenborg in the mid 18th century, and it gives a view of the afterlife that a very specific view of the afterlife that no other major religious organization has. It's very different in a lot of ways. It's what I call a real and substantial afterlife and not mystical or airy-fairy like almost all other religions have a view of the afterlife.
Well, just to carry that, and we'll get into the book a little bit here in a second, Joseph, but really for the folks who are listening today to kind of understand where you're coming from, you and this idea kind of rejects almost all, if I can say that, I hate to throw a blanket statement out there, but almost all religious views of death and the afterlife.
Yes, essentially yes, because the other religions do not have from their holy books any decent amount of material of what the afterlife is really like, and they leave it to the imagination of their adherents of how the afterlife will be like. Swedenborg, the Swedenborg Revelations total 29 volumes of over 18,000 pages of divine revelation, and one of them, the book Heaven and Hell, is 500 pages of detailed accounting of how the afterlife is structured, how heaven and hell are structured, what happens to you when you arrive there, and what you will do during your eternal afterlife. And that's a lot more information than any other religion has. And I base my book on that book of Swedenborg, Heaven and Hell, and constructed my novel around of the afterlife around that book.
So let's get to the book, Joseph. So it is a novel. We were talking about this before we actually started our conversation. It's a novel but it includes some fiction and nonfiction. So explain to us kind of the idea of the story behind The Travelers.
Well, the nonfictional part is I am part of the story, and in the Swedenborg novel, everybody dies in the first chapter. That's the whole fun of the Swedenborg novel is the author describing what the afterlife is really like, and I decided to be part of the story, so I quote-unquote die in the first chapter, along with eight other people. And these eight other people wake up in a spiritual version of the Fairfax Hospital. I live in Fairfax County, Virginia. And there starts their experience of what the afterlife is like. When you wake up in the spiritual world, you wake up in a place that looks very similar to the place that you left on Earth, or expected to be. If in case of another accident, you expected to be in a hospital, the hospital looks very much like the hospital on Earth, but with small differences that you finally get to think. He says, well, maybe I'm not on Earth anymore, and that's the basic idea of how you arrive there. And it's that part of the book that's basically non-fictional. It's my autobiographical story on Earth, along with when I paraphrase or quote Swedenborg, that's also non-fictional.
So it's... So the book itself, Joseph, is kind of, it's a story of real, of imaginary people who are following, though, the ideas and the philosophies that the Swedenborgs have. So it's kind of, you're trying to take that and put it into a kind of a real life kind of story. Is that basically it?
Yes. Yeah. And I selected a wide range of religious or belief systems, anywhere from an atheist to a fundamentalist Baptist, and anything in between, Catholics, Episcopalians, a person that has never thought about religion one way or the other. I select a wide range and then went through the process of putting it through the Swedenborgian belief system and seeing how they would react in the spiritual world when they arrive with that kind of a mentality from Earth.
Now, you are one of the characters, obviously, in the book, but you were also telling me that there's another character in the book, an angel, that is also really based on a real-life person that really had that particular story in real life, had a real impact on your life.
Yes, essentially, she was my best friend on the seventh grade when I was living in Costa Rica, and I mean, I loved her in a platonic sense. I mean, we were really very, very close, and I had a party, a goodbye party, because I was going to another country. My father was a diplomat, and she came to the party, and then 1 month later, I heard that she had died of a heart condition. And it was her death that introduced me to the Swedenborgian belief system, because my mother, seeing my grief that wouldn't end, read me a Swedenborgian novel that showed that she had not really died, that she simply had gone to the spiritual world. And that introduced me to the Swedenborgian belief system. And so therefore, her death had a very deep impact on me on almost every level that you can think of.
Now, Joseph, I think it's safe to say that your book will probably be, for a lot of people, quite frankly, controversial, because it does kind of go contrary to mainstream religious beliefs. Do you see your book as being controversial in nature?
Oh, yes, and I deliberately made it. I deliberately made it so, but I also had to, because the Swedenborgian belief system is controversial, because it gives a view of the afterlife in which is real and substantial, and eliminates this view of angels floating around in clouds, or you having to spend almost all your time singing hymns and praying to God and that kind of thing. No, that's not what the afterlife is like. People in heaven have real lives, live in real houses, and yes, they live as married couples, and yes, sex does exist in heaven, and yes, people do work in heaven. Of course, the term work on earth has kind of a negative connotation, but what they work on is the things that they love to do that are useful to other people. And they have, of course, time off and do wonderful things in their time off. And if you go to hell, it's a nasty place, but it's not a pits of fire. It's kind of like you're living in a slum type of thing. And there's, of course, rules in hell that the evil people there would like to violate, but if they try to violate them, they get the appropriate punishment to keep them under control. That's the basic structure of the spiritual world. With the one thing being that everybody arrives in the spiritual world in the world of spirits, which is the world between heaven and hell, and it's in the world of spirits where we either regenerate and then end up going to heaven, or degenerate if we decide to go to hell.
So it differs, obviously, in a lot of ways to mainstream religion, because they're in your book, and as these characters go through it, there's not one specific way to heaven or hell.
No, there isn't. Essentially, you know, each individual chooses his own path of to go to heaven or to hell. The one thing I have to emphasize here is that God does not send anybody to hell. You send yourself to hell. That is, you choose to go there because you'd rather be in hell and be surrounded with people that think like you, that is, in not very nice ways, rather than be surrounded by what they would call do-gooders and have to suffer that kind of a emotional disconnect. So, like I said, hell is not a nice place, but it's also not eternal torture and damnation. They just don't live in very nice places, but if they behave themselves, the life there is tolerable. But of course, they don't always behave themselves, and that's where the punishment aspect of hell comes in.
So why did you write this book, Joe? Obviously, this is part of your own, your very personal belief system, but why did you decide to sit down, pen and paper, and write this particular story?
And during the year 2011, more and more I was thinking on religious terms. I had the discussions with other Swedenborgians through email. I had events happening that kind of make me think it on a religious angle and think again about Swedenborg in detail. And it reached a critical, and my mother was getting sick, and I could see that, you know, she was headed toward her transition, which is what death is. And that got me thinking in religious terms, and eventually these feelings and thoughts reached critical mass inside of me in December of 2011, and I just sat down and started writing, and I ended the book, the first draft, on July 2012. And after a couple of months, I said, well, I might try to publish this, and I did.
So who do you hope, I'm trying to look out and determine who your target audience is, or who did you write this book for, and what is it that you hope they get from it?
Okay, my main target audience, I mean, I would welcome anybody from any belief system to read it, of course, but my main target audience is the agnostics. especially the believing agnostics, at least the people that firmly believe that there is some kind of God, or at least some kind of conscious supreme being, but does not believe in any of the specifics of any religious organizations because it's irrational. I target this to these people because these people are willing to accept the rationality and logic of the Swedenborgian belief system and are looking for a religion that makes sense. So I'm going, my main emphasis is on the agnostics and also on people that, well, they know that their time is coming soon and are afraid. I find that this book would be useful to allay their fears of what's going to happen to them relatively soon, and for them to realize that they're going into a wonderful place that is real and substantial, that you arrive there as the person that you were on Earth, and you have, you know, if you're a man, you're still a man, that, you know, things are still real and substantial under different rules, some different rules. Space and time work somewhat differently there, but you don't become into something that's unreal. And I use this book to help these people allay those fears about death.
Again, the name of the book is The Travelers, The Wonders of Journeying in the Afterlife. Joseph Scotts is the author. He's with us today on the Indie Book Publishing and Balboa Press line. Joseph, where can we find The Travelers?
You can find it, the easiest way would be in the Amazon.com. And it's better to Google my last name, Scotts, rather than the title, because there's 50 or 60 books with the word travelers in it. So if you can just Google Sconce, S-C-O-N-C-E, then you'll find it in Amazon.com.
Now, do you have a website or a blog or anywhere?
I'm setting that up. I'm setting up the social media over the next month or two, and I will be informing Balboa Press about it. The process of setting this up.
Yeah, they're not easy to do. So we've just got a minute or so left here today, Joseph. If there was one thing that you could say to a potential reader, a potential person that might pick up your book today about The Travelers, what would you say to them?
If you want to know what the afterlife is really like, how it functions, and why it functions that way, read the book. And because one thing is guaranteed, every one of us at some point is going to go into the afterlife. So therefore, I think it's important for people to get a basic understanding of, at least of the basic aspects of how the afterlife works.
All right. One more time. The name of the book is The Travelers, The Wonders of Journeying in the Afterlife, written by Joseph Scotts. That's S-C-O-N-C-E. Joseph has been with us today on the Indie Book Publishing line, courtesy of Balboa Press. Joseph, thanks so much for being with us today, and good luck with your book.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Abbott Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Forged in Philadelphia. Our author, Rebecca Eckfeldt Gibby, is my guest today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jay.
You're joining me from New Jersey in the United States.
That's correct.
What is the background story of Forged in Philadelphia? This is not an extensive read, 110 pages. What was the inspiration behind your doing this particular book?
Well, the original inspiration was a family story that my father told with great pride about an ancestor who had been instrumental in the coining of the first U.S. coins in Philadelphia in 1792.
Mm.
And that was a story I grew up with and was fascinated by, and finally had some time after retirement to put pen to paper and write it up.
Any possibility that you have a copy of that coin?
You know, there's one. It's interesting that you should say that, because I just had a visit to Mount Vernon, and there is a coin in their new museum there that is the half dime, or one of the 1,500 half dimes that were cast in that first printing.
Wow. Well, I would hope, I mean, if I were you, I would be looking in my sock drawer to see if I could find one of those.
Well, they're very rare, and they're very, very expensive.
That's what I was thinking.
I think the last auction of coins was, you know, they were way up in the $75,000 range.
Oh, my. You've been writing since a young age.
Yes.
What inspired you to begin as a child writing writing stories and
Well, I think I'm really an actor at heart.
Mm-hmm.
I love a good story, and I love acting them out, and that's what I did as a child. And then I started writing them, and then when I got a little older, I started writing children's musicals and directed them as well. And it's just sort of been a passion of mine my whole life. I've been into drama and writing stories.
In this book, Forged in Philadelphia, is it totally nonfiction, or are there some fictional stories that are woven into the account?
There's an interesting fictional story that I've woven in, and that is about a slave of George Washington's, who actually did live, Ona Judge. And she ran away when President and Mrs. Washington were living in Philadelphia, because, of course, Philadelphia was the capital of the country at a certain point. They were living in Philly. And their slave ran away, and my ancestor, Adam Eckfeldt, also had a slave who ran away about the same time, and we have that documented. And the fictional part of the story is how they met, how they fell in love, and how they ran away together. The slave population in Philly was not large at that point, because Philadelphia was filled with abolitionists, and the Quaker movement was very strong for anti-slavery. But it is possible that these two people did meet, but that's the fictional part of it.
But your book is not just a historical read or documentation. It's actually a storyline that you've written.
It's a love story, really, about Ona Judge and Christian the slave, and how they found each other and ran away together in the environment of Philadelphia, which, of course, was a very interesting location to be because of the Quakers and the anti-slavery. And George Washington himself had slaves. The Pennsylvania laws at that point did not allow, if a slave was in residence more than 6 months, they could be set free. So President and Mrs. Washington were very careful to not break the law, and they would rotate their slaves from Virginia up to Pennsylvania so that they didn't have to free them.
Fascinating. How long did it take you, Becky, to get this story completed?
I would say a year. I did a lot of research. One of the points of research that I didn't expect was my interest in the currency and how important the currency was to George Washington at that point. He wanted to establish credibility abroad, particularly with France. And so he wanted to have high-grade silver coins circulated. And at that point, there were not high-grade metals coming out of the mines in Pennsylvania. So the story is that in order to get the high-grade silver, they used Martha Washington's tea service that she had brought up from Mount Vernon and melted down that silverware to make the 1,500 coins that was part of the casting.
Fascinating story. Is there other events or other activities or things that you discovered in your research that may be new and exciting to the reader?
Well, I think the middle grade and young adult readers won't know much about the abolitionist movement at that time. Of course, most of our focus in history is focused on the slavery issue around the Civil War, not the Revolutionary. And I myself was surprised at how strong particularly the Pennsylvania laws were dealing with anti-slavery at that time in our history. I really didn't know too much about it until I started my research.
What do you want readers to take away from this read?
Well, I want them to understand the interest that Washington had in international commerce and the credibility that he wanted to establish with the foreign nations, that the U.S. was a force to be reckoned with and hadn't just declared their independence for their own citizens, but they wanted the credibility in the commercial world market. And that was a new and different concept for me. I also want them to realize that young people can pursue their dreams. Adam Eckfeld, who went on to be the chief coiner at the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia, he was born into a blacksmith family. His father wanted him to take over the business, but he had other interests. And so it's his quest for moving on with his life and not being tied down to the family business and moving on to this passion that he had to make a difference in the world. And that storyline runs synonymously with the story of Christian and Ona, the two slaves, that we all quest something in our lives, and it doesn't matter what age or who we are or what socioeconomic bracket, that we pursue those dreams, and those dreams can be fulfilled.
The story of the past is still applicable to the present.
Absolutely.
And to the future.
Every day.
And to the future. As an author, do you journal by any chance?
I do occasionally. I'm more a poet in my journaling. I love to write poetry, and it's often things that are on my mind. I send a Christmas card every year that is a poem. And, my journaling takes the form of poems, usually.
As a creative, have you received any advice as you were younger that has stuck with you and helped you to forge your path towards authorship?
Well, one of the things that I think was hard for me when I made the transition from writing children's musicals to writing an actual fictional story was that I wasn't really good at dialogue. I was very good at dialogue, but I wasn't so good at setting the stage, because in drama, of course, the stage is set for you with the scenery and the So I had to learn how to make those transitions from the dialogue to the narrative, and that was an interesting change for me, and that took a little bit of training. I went to some classes, and I joined some authors groups, and I think I learned a lot through that.
Have you decided that it was a painless process, and you might want to consider writing an additional follow-up book to this one?
People have asked me about writing a follow-up book to this one, and I hadn't really considered it until I've started getting those questions. I definitely am going to write more, and I haven't decided whether there'll be follow-ups to this, but there are other stories that I want to tell about some family members that are fascinating, and I will be writing again.
Did you begin this story by, producing an outline, or did you just start from inspiration and go from there?
A little bit of both. I had the narrative, I had the storyline pretty much because of the history of it, but I had to embellish it, and I had to do a lot of research, and that was really what took the bulk of the time. The writing, after I had the research done, the story kind of wrote itself.
Share a recap of Forged in Philadelphia in a couple of paragraphs that will get my listeners more interested in getting their own copy.
Well, Adam Eckfeldt was born to a blacksmith family, and that's what his father wanted him to do, but he had other thoughts, and he was very, very impressed with the delegates from Philadelphia who were in and around the city, and he wanted to make a bigger difference in the world. And so he and he was very creative. So he got himself known to the people that counted at that point. And he went on to have the idea of using the Washington silver as the basis for the casting of these U.S. coins. But in and amongst that story are a lot of other themes, as I had said, the anti-slavery movement, the abolitionists, the Quaker movement in Philadelphia that was so strong, and of course through it all is President and Mrs. Washington, who are central figures to the story.
Any action scenes that might make a great stage play?
Well, there is a scene in the in President's house, which was where President and Mrs. Washington were living at that point, where this delegate of David Washington and some other men from Philadelphia have to present to Lady Washington the idea that she donate her silverware, which was preposterous to the president. But she, being a good woman and a good devoted citizen to the country and to the cause at that point, was more open-minded. And she also had other things down in Mount Vernon. She did not lack for resources, and so there was probably a lot of other silverware that she could use, even though she donated this large bit.
That's a fascinating story, fascinating backstory. Was there a challenge in getting this completed?
I think writing is isolating. I wrote it the year after I had retired, so that is different in itself. You know, you're not going to an office every day. You're by yourself. I find that you have to be very disciplined and you have to be structured, particularly when you're by yourself and you're trying to set your schedule so that you do a little bit of writing each day. And I found that the hardest. It required the most discipline from me.
Fascinating story, Forged in Philadelphia. Our author, Rebecca Eckfeld Gibby. Rebecca, where do we get copies of your book?
My book is available at barnesandnoble.com and at amazon.com. And if you go into Barnes & Noble, you can order it there. Or you can get it from Abbott Press. Sorry.
Abbott Press. And do you have a website yet?
I do. It's regibby.com.
R-E-Gibby. Gibby spelled G-I-B-B-Y. Thank you, Becky, for joining me today. This is a book that should be of interest to a lot of people. I love the background stories you've shared, so thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Jay. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Abbott Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.